Hello and welcome to this, the second Pilot TV podcast, the weekly news and review show celebrating and curating the very best in cinematic television. And if you listened to the first one, well, we're thrilled and more than a little surprised you've come back for a second go. And we promise that there'll be less mention of self-love in this week's podcast. I'm Terry White, the editor-in-chief of Pilot TV, and I'm joined by two colleagues who love telly more than they could ever possibly love any other human being, like the true psychopaths that they are. First up, we have Deputy Editor, TV's Boyd Hilton.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Boyd. How are you?
I'm very well. I don't know how you can promise there won't be that much discussion of masturbation because we haven't actually recorded the podcast yet.
I know. I'm kind of promising on behalf of myself and hoping it reaches James Dyer mainly.
I have at least five masturbatory anecdotes ready to go.
Good. We're off to a good start. Now, Boyd, last week we talked about your celebrity friends, specifically Russell Tovey and Dermot O'Leary. But I was thinking that I don't think it does justice to the scale and scope of your celebrity friendships. I mean, these friendships are in large part why you are given the title of TV's Boyd Hilton.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That and your immense knowledge of television. So, we'd like some more. Can you tell us who your most famous friend is?
It's probably David Walliams, I guess. Yeah, David. Ooh. Yeah, David I've known for... He's the one I've known the longest of my celebrity friends. Yeah, properly, yeah. Since back in the day of Rock Profile.
I was really excited when he started following me on Twitter until I realised he follows everyone on Twitter.
He follows quite a lot of people.
He follows
Follows like 9,000 people.
He's one of those people who went from completely rejecting all forms of social media to embracing them more than anyone in the world ever.
Well, shall I tell you my David Walliams story? And it is this. My friend Alex, Alex Very, was a videator.
I'm sorry. Can we stop? His name is Alex Very.
Yeah, he is Very.
Very what?
He's Very everything. You need to meet him. But anyway,
he's a videator.
He's a videator. So he was like a video game gladiator. And he went by the name Big Boy Barry because he is a big boy. His name's not Barry, though. Anyway, and this was in the 80s. So he was in the... He was on this show and he got his own spin-off show. He was the most popular videator on Games World. And he got his own spin-off show called Barry's Joypad. You see what they did there?
Yes.
And he was obviously the lead and he had a comedy sidekick played by David Walliams.
Yes, David did. Yes, that's correct. I can confirm he was on Games World. Yeah.
So he played second string to my mate Alex.
How is this your story?
Because I like to inject myself into really everything.
Okay, good, good. And Boyd, what's the most showbiz thing you've ever done with David Walliams? Or
we went to see Kylie with Elton and David. Elton John and David Furnish.
No.
That was the foursome with me, David, Elton John and David Furnish watching Kylie, and then we went back and met her afterwards and hugged her.
This is news. I didn't realise you were quite such a colossal star fucker. This is quite extraordinary.
I mean, the fact that you don't realise I'm the world's greatest name dropper is frankly ludicrous.
And I just dropped Big Boy Barry and thought that was pretty egregious. So, all right, fair enough.
Good. Well, we've already met James, but let's introduce you formally. Hi. You are the other deputy editor of Pilot TV. And James, apart from Empire's Chris Hewitt, who is your most famous friend?
Can I say Empire's Nick DeSemlin?
You can. It's quite the double act.
Yeah. I don't have any.
Although I think you should really
say
Empire's Terry White.
Should I?
Yeah.
Well, Terry is quite famous.
Saying, yeah.
I don't have a lot of celebrities don't like me, I think, really, is what it comes down to.
Is it your spiky interview technique?
It might be my complete ineptitude and lack of preparation, probably more than anything else. Yeah, the closest I ever came was I hung out with Arnold a few times. Schwarzenegger. So just the first term, just Arnold. But I don't think we can say we're friends. I'm just that journalist who he once met.
No, but you've spoken a few times, right? And I believe he knows who you are.
I think my entire relationship with Arnold Schwarzenegger can be summed up by the time he came to the Empire Awards, where I went up to him and went, "Arnold, great to see you," and I shook his hand, and he's like, "Hello," and I went, "Oh, how have you been?" You know, and he just kind of looked at me with clearly no fucking clue who I was, and then I saw his aide slip him a piece of paper, and he looked at it, and then he went, "James," and threw his arms around, "How are you?" And it's like, so 2 seconds ago, you had no clue who I was, but suddenly this piece of paper clearly said, "Oh, he wrote that great article. You should be nice to him." And so he was.
That is very good.
Yeah.
That's very good. I'm trying to think who might... I don't really have famous friends.
That's
not
true.
Do you think is it against your journalistic principle to befriend the people that you have to deal with professionally? I obviously do not follow that rule.
I mean, kind of. Also, I think I have an awkwardness about me that means that if you persevere with me, I think I grow on you. But I think an instant first meeting, there's something a little bit odd about me.
Right.
Which puts famous people off because they kind of think she might be one of those people who turns up at the foot of my bed at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Being like, "Hey, want to go get a cocktail?"
It's that bit where they meet you and they glimpse their own death briefly.
Yeah. It's the madness in the kind of whites of my eyes that I think gives it away.
Yeah, you've betrayed a certain amount of self-awareness there. That's good, yeah.
Oh, I've got loads of self-awareness. Okay. I just don't do anything about it.
Have you been on TV? If we're talking about TV. I know Boyd's been on you literally
were on
every
Westworld,
show ever.
Show.
I was.
Not that kind of TV, like dramatic TV.
Oh, have I been an extra?
Yeah.
No.
Nothing.
How is that a claim to fame?
It's not an extra. It's not really. I'm just teeing up my own particular
anecdote. Go on, look, you've been an extra.
It's all about teeing up his own anecdote.
In early 90s British sitcom Bonjour La Classe, starring Nigel Planer.
That is fantastic.
There you go.
We need more.
Yeah. It was shot at my school, and I was in the chapel scene, and there was a bit where you could just see me there, sort of smiling inanely at the camera. And there's a bit of me walking. They cut, without my sign off, they did not speak to my people about this. They filmed me from behind, which is problematic because I was underage. They filmed me from behind walking down a path towards the lunch hall, and there's this lingering shot on my arse as I walk towards lunch. I'm not sure to this day.
Dias, how old?
I guess I must have been about 16.
How disturbing.
Yeah.
The only thing that would have been shot on my school would have been a Ken Loach film. So
Ken Loach's next film could be shot in your.
Maybe.
I ran into Ken Loach in Forbidden Planet. Can I just say that again? I ran into Ken Loach in Forbidden Planet.
What was he buying?
It's very hard to say.
Should I check it out? No, I was just absolutely
gobsmacked. Because you see him, you think, you know, used needles and donkey jackets. You don't think limited edition Superman first runs. But, you know, he's a man of many, many layers. He's very textured.
He is. I was an extra in Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's film Cemetery Junction. Another one of my celebrity friends is Ricky. And he insisted that I was an extra so they could put me in a wig. So I'm in a 70s wig. In that film, if you want to see half a second of me.
Is that on the internet?
It must be on the internet, yeah.
Pictures of you on the internet?
Probably, yeah.
Well, let's find good. It.
Yeah.
I was nearly an extra in the first Hitman film. Because I'm bald. There was a bit where I was talking to the director who was going a bit rogue. We were on set and he said, oh no, we'll put you in the back of a car and we'll just put the button, and you can just be his stunt double and you can go in the car because they're going to fly down the road, it's going to be a chase. And I was like, this sounds amazing. They're going to put a barcode on me and I'm going to be the hitman stunt double. And then someone from the production went up to him and just went, no, absolutely not. For so many reasons, not least of all the law and insurance. And so they wouldn't let me do it and I felt robbed.
Now, James, I'm surprised you're on such good form because it's been a week since the last podcast. We did the first one, we did it live, and we're now in a tiny, tiny meeting room in Camden.
Yeah.
But you've been on roller coasters for the last week.
I have, yes. I've been at Universal Studios enjoying their Halloween Horror Nights, being scared by things, having people jump out at me.
Does that technically work?
I mean, it's not dissimilar to coming to work in Camden, if I'm brutally honest with you. You know, just knife-wielding lunatics screaming in your face and hurling themselves at you from sort of shadowy corners. It's much the same. So I felt uniquely qualified to weather it.
Yeah, I've been experiencing the Halloween Horror Nights in Camden for the last week, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also for the last week, it's been quite a big week in telly, Boyd, right?
Huge.
Like, massive. It's actually, it really reminds me of the 90s, because you come in to work in the morning, even in this office, and instead of talking about Trump or Brexit or some other element of the impending apocalypse, people are talking about telly again. It's really exciting.
Particularly Bodyguard, obviously, which we're going to come on to. But I think the BBC, I have to say, and I keep saying this to everyone who will listen, is going through an incredible period of drama, because everyone always goes on about Netflix and Amazon Prime to a less extent because they're so cool and trendy. But good old effing BBC is absolutely kicking it out of the park. Is that the phrase?
No. Knocking it, Boyd.
Kicking the ball somewhere and knocking.
To watch for the sporting references. That is this week's talking point.
Yes.
The BBC's Purple Patch, and also second week on the trot, it feels like it has to be Bodyguard, which has still got people kind of losing their minds slightly. Are we in that phase of this
TV
show?
I feel a bit guilty.
Show?
Like, on the last podcast, I referred to it as being great, but a little bit shit in the best possible way. And I feel I need to qualify that a little bit because it's now just become brilliant across the board. It wasn't shit. I just meant it was a little bit, should we say, heightened. Trashy is a word I'm not going to use, but you know what I mean. Like, when it was all, like, he was shagging her and it was all a bit soapy. And now it's turned into, you know, proper thick conspiracy territory and I'm fucking loving it.
Can you follow all of it or does it matter?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think it's very... I mean, the plausibility is only problematic in that this government seems quite competent at what they're doing. And their scandals are really carried off very, very well. It's hard to believe the current administration being able to assassinate people anywhere near that creatively. But, you know, it's good shit. I'm enjoying it a lot.
I think you're not meant to entirely understand at this stage. So we've just seen episode 5 of the penultimate episode. And episode 5 was the one where he's kind of lining up all the suspects, all the different kind of branches of government and the spies and the Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, and then he's kind of gathering them all together and saying, which of these is going to end up being responsible for the central bad things that have happened, which will all be revealed in the finale. So I think this was the most complicated episode by far.
Yeah.
And you're not, I think you're meant to understand every single detail of it. It's all a bit, well, who is doing what to who? We don't know yet.
Yeah, and what do you think we've got set, without spoilers, but yeah, what would you predict we've got in store for us with the final?
Well, I have seen the finale, so I pretend I haven't seen the finale.
Oh,
and
course,
all
yeah.
I will say is, it's difficult. What I will say is, there's a whole big set piece thing that happens, nothing to do with who's doing what to whom, that is so incredibly effective. Even though you know almost certainly that the person involved probably won't die, for example, without wanting to be any more severe than that, it's still just like that opening, the train sequence. This set piece sequence, it's not as tense as that, but it's so well done that you're in the middle of it and you're like, you're really experiencing this ludicrous situation, which as they're watching it, I guarantee people on Twitter are going, this is preposterous, and yet loving it at the same time. I think that's the thing that's happening all the way through. People are going, elements of this are definitely testing our relationship to the truth, but you're still accepting it because it's such good fun.
See, I've been trying to resist the temptation to go onto the media site and watch the rest of it, so I'm watching it with everyone else. But I reckon Gina McGee's well dodge.
Maybe. You know those people who still think, by the way, that she's going to come back from the dead?
Yeah.
I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I'm a truther.
Okay.
She's not dead.
I'm not going to spoil it.
She's not dead.
But why do you think people are so willing to kind of not really care about the implausibility? Because it gives people do sound off about it, but then they're clearly tuning in again to keep watching.
Because he takes it, if he just wasn't taking it to the edges of credulity of what's believable, then it wouldn't be as much fun. So it's like the two things have to go hand in hand. It would just be a bland, normal BBC drama about cops and politicians. But because he does take it so far, that's what makes it fun. So
yeah,
it has to be borderline ludicrous.
It's what Line of Duty is, isn't it? It's otherwise, it would just be endless filling out of forms and paperwork.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's not a lot of drama in actual police administration.
I mean, if you compare it, the only BBC drama I think isn't working on is Press, which is the one about newspapers. And that, in that, there isn't much happening. And you compare it to this, and they're both, you know, workplace dramas.
I was about to say, it sounds a lot like
journalism. It is incredible. The comparison is not working for Press.
Is that because it's too real? It's just loads of people subbing grammatical
kind of
errors.
Is, yeah, and tabloid journalists wandering around shouting at each other. It's like, well, I don't really care.
Wow.
James, are you watching episodically? So are you watching weekly?
I have been watching them weekly, which I don't like to do. I'm more of a binger. But I've held off doing that because I'm quite enjoying being swept up in the kind of Monday morning discussion of it all.
And the other thing, it totally underlines the point that linear TV is still absolutely with us and will never, I predict, ever go away. The joy of communally talking about it, as you say, that doesn't happen with Netflix shows. And Netflix made their USP, we're going to show everything in one go, all 10 episodes online in one go, which is great for them, and that's fine. But I think actually the old school channels have to stick with this stuff and have to do these kind of big, tense, communal viewing experiences because it is what separates them out.
Yeah, well, and we'll move on now to reviews and we're going to kick it off with Killing Eve because this ties into this conversation, which is a really interesting setup in terms of how they're showing it, right? So they're showing it Saturday night. It was the premiere episode this Saturday, but then they put all 8 episodes up on iPlayer. So it was really interesting because I've really fallen back in love with linear TV, as you say, and that kind of episodic nature. They're talking about it the next morning, following along with people on social. It really reminded me of what a great experience communal TV is and actually how isolating watching stuff on your own can be because you don't get that sense of conversation and all having one experience at the same time. It's why I love the cinema, because you're experiencing something along with a load of other people. But Killing Eve, I couldn't, oh my God, it was like crack. I couldn't help myself. So I watched the first one. I held off because we had early access and I held off and I'm like, I'm going to wait and I'm going to watch it with everybody else. And then I just couldn't stop myself and I binged. On Sunday, I went through every single other episode and I kept telling myself that lie. Wow. Just one more, just one more, just one more. And before you knew it, I'd watched all 8 and kind of regretted it and felt guilty, like I just had a giant greasy Domino's or something and felt so guilty and bad. And for everybody must have read about this now. This has been a huge hit already in the States. And it actually shares some similarities with Bodyguard in terms of genre. Obviously, it's a thriller. Starring Sandra Oh and Jodie Comer, both of whom are exceptional. Written by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is just the most remarkable talent. And we were talking about this earlier, myself and James, about what makes this so great. Amongst, you know, it's a genre that has been flooded over the years. I mean, there's so many different elements to it, part of which is women writing women means you get really convincing, multi-textured, layered women. the humanity and kind of the flaws at the heart of these women. So even Sandro's character, who you're meant to believe is the person who's going to have to save the world, they joke about her a lot, but she's in MI5 and she's kind of running this small, slightly clumsy unit who are meant to be finding this assassin who's killing people all over the world. But she's bumbling and she's like us. You kind of expect these people to be beyond reproach and be perfection. And she's just a really, really normal human being. And Jodie Comer is just astonishing. It's one of the performances of the year, I think, so far for me. But is this the first time they've done this, Boyd, in terms of the way they're distributing it?
It's not. They have, so they've done it a couple of times. So there was a big kind of ghost drama they did it with, the name of which I've forgotten, where they showed it on Friday night at 9 o'clock and they put it all online as well, 8 episodes. They've done it a couple of times. I think it is, I don't think they've fully thought it through. And I have spoken to some BBC types about this, like to get, you know, why have they decided to do this with this show? And I think it's partly literally the BBC saying we need to be a bit like Netflix.
Right.
Like we can't just let Netflix dominate the young people watching TV on their laptops in their own time. Mm. And so this show, which is so kind of edgy and it does have a very kind of youthful vibe, despite the fact actually that most of the characters are well into their, you know, I don't know, approaching middle age, apart from Jodie Comer's one. So they're kind of going, we can do a really cool show that's as cinematic and good as the Netflix shows, of which the best ones, and put it all out online like they do. And yet we can also show it on Saturday night for old school people who don't really have Netflix and will watch it happily in a linear fashion. So I can see why they're doing it, but I still think it's slightly a muddled approach.
Mm. There's also the fact that, bear in mind, this aired in the States, was it like 6 months ago?
Yeah.
So it's not a new thing globally, it's just a new thing for us in the UK. Now, it aired episodically in the States, didn't it?
Yeah. America,
so I guess at this point, it's a bit like the cat's a little bit out of the bag, isn't it? Mm. So I think the talkability wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't have that Monday morning thing, except for the people, I guess, that you know. Because most people will have either heard what had happened or at least heard a lot about it.
Yeah.
It's not come out of nowhere. But I absolutely love this. And I've been sitting on it for ages, been meaning to watch it. And I mainlined the entire thing on my flight to Florida. And like you say, Jodie Comer is amazing as this kind of playful sociopath. She has this kind of insouciance to her. She's so much fun and she has so much fun with the role. And it's quite a serious subject matter. It's quite unpleasant at times, quite, you know, murderous, gory. There's a lot of violence in it. But there's this thread of incredibly funny dark humour all the way through it. So you just can't help yourself laughing at it. And it is a joyous show. I haven't enjoyed a show as much as this in a long time.
You're right. The writing is just, and that's where that humour comes in. They undercut what is meant to be such, you know, kind of threatening, foreboding scenes. There'll just be a quip, usually from Sandro, and suddenly the entire thing's been undercut. Even that opening scene where she's sat in a cafe, smiling at the little girl who playfully smiles at the man, and you can see, and that's a great study of psychopathy as well, how she reacts in that scene when the little girl doesn't pay her attention and pays the man the attention. And then she just walks past and you think, you know, she's going to like ruffle her hair or something. She spills her pudding into her lap. And it's just such a brilliantly light touch in terms of setting the scene on who she is and the tone of this show.
What I also love about it is that the stuff that when it's dealing with, you kind of alluded to earlier, when it's dealing with the workplace of MI5 and MI6, these spies. And it's such a contrast actually with Bodyguard, because Bodyguard, no one says anything that's outside of the actual plot. And there's no, and I kind of love that about him. It's got that, there's no backstories. It's just, everyone just does what they're doing. Even the sex was like, right, I'm going to start masturbating and that means I want you to have sex with me. It's very matter of fact. Whereas in this, in Killing Eve, she takes the time to let the characters kind of live. And so there's, at the beginning, there's a great bit where they're arriving at work and they're all working in espionage, but they're fighting over a croissant, as you do probably every Monday morning when you're at Empire. And that
like anyone brings us croissants.
Well, and that, I thought that was so clever that it's making this world, which is usually a glamorous world of spies, into just an everyday workplace.
Yeah.
Stuff like that's happening all the way through, which makes it, even though they're incredibly kind of lavish, operatic murders in it, there's also time for it to be very real and authentic and kind of totally believable.
The interplay, like in particular that Villanelle, Jodie Comer's character, has with her handler, this sort of long-suffering, kind of roly-eyed guy, Constantin, is just so, so funny. She's so playful with him and they have so much fun with those sequences and with the language that they use. Mm. Like the linguistics are really interesting. So when they're talking about a castration scene at one point and one of the characters, she's come out with it, she goes, she chopped his knob off. And it's just like, just the use of words. It's so good. So
my
good.
My favourite is Fiona Shaw. Fiona Shaw,
she's good in everything.
Grande Dame, British theatre, is playing such a fun, somehow lovable, yet kind of harsh. She's just fantastic. And she's clearly having the time of her life.
There's a lot of Mrs. Dursley in that character, to be honest. There really is. She's channeling a lot of that.
And we must talk about the soundtrack as well, because I just think the use of music is just remarkable as well. Again, it's another thing that makes it feel cinematic and really makes it feel like it could be on the big screen as easily as be on the little screen.
Yeah, it's got a little bit Peaky Blinders either way, does it? Yeah, kind of long, quite long action scenes timed beautifully to the music. Yeah, no, it's phenomenal.
So Killing Eve, we love it. And definitely. The second episode will be on BBC One next Saturday.
But none of that matters because you should watch them all today.
And all of them are on iPlayer right now if you're like me and have absolutely no patience or self-control. Now, we're going to talk about Maniac, James Dyer.
We are. Now, this is a miniseries which opens on Netflix this Friday. And now is the part where I would tell you the story of this show. But I haven't the first fucking clue because I didn't understand a word of it. But in the best way possible. This is based on a Norwegian television series of the same name. And it's adapted here by Patrick Somerville. It's got Emma Stone and Jonah Hill in it. And the first episode, and I believe the second one as well, are very much kind of scene setters. You're just watching going, these people are great. What the hell is going on? And I feel a little bit like if this didn't have Jonah Hill and Emma Stone in it, I probably wouldn't have made it past the first episode because I'd have just thought, this is either nonsense or I'm too stupid to understand it. But that there in it, I think, keeps you going long enough for it to get its hooks in, and that's really important. So this, the two of them, I guess, take part in a clinical trial for a drug. There's a lot more going on in the first episode, but that's essentially where that ends. And then the series becomes this sort of exploration of what happens when they work through their psychological issues on this test drug by transporting themselves into different scenarios with reflections of their own characters. And it plays out like almost like a weird sort of compilation of different stories. But it's really, really darkly funny in a similar way, actually, to the way Killing Eve is. It's a very dark thread of humour to it. It shares a lot of DNA with Legion, I think, in the way that it has. I think it revels in its sort of weirdness in a similar way, and it has that slightly retro future tech aesthetic, the kind of way you can imagine people in the 80s imagine living in 2018, but really compelling. And I think, I mean, of them all, Jonah Hill is great in this, but Emma Stone really stood out for me in this, absolutely magnetic in this, to the point where I think you miss her horribly whenever she's off screen. But really enjoyed this. I think the most important piece of advice here is stick with it. Like, it's very easy, I think, to be put off by how demented the first episode is. But it does settle into a groove. What did we think? Has everyone seen this?
Yes. It's funny, you know, we've got a franchise in our Pilot TV magazine called Give It Time, which is kind of all about how long do you give these big multi-part shows. I have to insist that everyone goes through all the way to episode 5.
Yeah.
And I think why is because I've met a lot of people who watch the first two episodes and are completely in a state of bewilderment and are like and almost bored.
That's where I am. Right. Episode 2. I've no idea what's happening.
There you go. So because the premise of the show, which is that these two damaged people who meet at this clinical trial, it's what happens to them once they're involved in the trial and once they're going on these kind of lucid dream journeys together to wherever they can go, anywhere in the world and beyond. So, you know, they might go to a Lord of the Rings style world,
which they do.
They might go to the first one in episode 4. So even it's not till episode 4 where they go on their first lucid dream type adventure, which is the premise of the show. So it's kind of bold and yet slightly annoying that it takes that long to get to that moment. And the first one is a kind of 80s style, almost teen caper kind of thing, and is very funny and entertaining. We also don't meet, for example, Justin Theroux's character, who is the comic relief of the whole series until episode 3. So it's got this weird kind of almost deliberately, almost willfully perverse way of delaying that, explaining what the whole bloody show's about. And I think that's the creators, Kerry Fukunaga, who directed True Detective, Patrick Somerville, who wrote a lot of The Leftovers, the last season of Leftovers. And if you've seen The Leftovers, it's one of the most kind of slightly weird storytelling thing, that a bit like Westworld, where nothing's really explained and you have to really pay attention. He does that here. I think it does finally reward your patience. So when you do get to episodes 3, 4, 5, it really picks up for me and it flies. And from then on, I absolutely loved it and I've watched the whole rest of it. And I think it's an incredible, as you say, it's a particular showcase for her, Emma Stone, who just is absolutely brilliant. And I interviewed Kerry Fukunaga for Pilot TV magazine, and he said she never ever likes doing any film or TV work, anything that's set in a fantasy world of any kind. She hates it. And this was his way of tying her down and forcing her to be in that kind of format. And she has a brilliant time.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, he is a really exciting and interesting filmmaker, which is kind of why I gave it a go, I have to say, at the end of episode two. I ended up doing that thing which I did through all season two of Westworld, which was Googling what happened in the last episode of Westworld.
Yeah.
And it infuriates me because I worry that sometimes with... I've seen a couple of things recently, both films and TV, where it feels like a produced, what I would call a produced filmmaking, which is we're going to prove we're much more intelligent than you. So when you said either, like, you know, I'm not clever enough for this, which is stupid, you're James Dye, you've got the biggest brain in well, this room. There's only four of us in it. But, you know, you're a very intelligent man. And I there are parts of me that I weren't prepared to work hard for certain shows. But if it feels like too many hoops are being put in my way to jump through to make me earn the enjoyment of the show, then that kind of really puts me off. But I trust you, Boyd Hilton.
Thank you.
You are TV's Boyd Hilton. You are a good friend of David Walliams, TV's Boyd Hilton.
And he's also a maniac.
And you're a psychopath. Yeah. So I'm going to give it a go on three and four. But you think that if you get that far, the rest of the episode is kind of... is it easier to navigate?
I think you want... Yeah, because particularly three and four, it gets you into the idea of the show that these two are going to go on these weird flights of fantasy together. And that is really what... It was the whole premise of the show is that, is putting these two characters in whatever situation we want to imagine them in. Genres, it's playing with genre, it's playing with filmmaking techniques. It's kind of, there's a self-awareness to it from that point of view. And yet at the same time, it is about something which is kind of about how do damaged people try and fix themselves.
Mm. It reminded me a bit of Eternal Sunshine in that premise.
There is an Eternal Sunshiny thing going on, without doubt.
There's a lot of Eternal Sunshine in this, very much so. Like it brought that to my mind a lot. Much more that than, you know, for example, Superbad, which was, of course, the last time these two were on screen together.
Oh, God, of course.
Yeah. And it's quite nice. Joan Hill was very much underplaying PTSD. It. Joan Hill was kind of like, he's depressed in it, and that's kind of, you know, and he has... issues.
His physicality struck me in the first one. He looks unrecognisable. Absolutely. I mean, he's a lot smaller than he used to be, but his face looks so ravaged that he almost doesn't even need to do much, does he? Because his entire, the way he sits, he literally sits like the man with all of the sadness in the world, bowing his head.
And he's apparently very method and wanted to get depressed as well.
Wow.
I applaud him.
Yes.
Well, he's really low energy and she's really kind of frenetic and sort of like twitchy.
Yeah, but she did remind me of Kate Winslet's character in Eternal Sunshine in that Clementine. Sense. So, James, when is this on again?
It's on Friday, drops on Netflix, so that's your weekend sorted.
Great, and there will be a Pilot TV video show special of Maniac, Mr. Boyd Hilton, interviewing the stars and director, and we will be talking about it as well out in a few days. Now, Boyd, let us round up the review section with an Australian crime drama.
Yes, Mystery Road. So this is in the BBC 4 Saturday night 9 o'clock slot where they put all their foreign dramas. It's, you know, where The Killing was on and The Bridge was on. Yeah. James is looking at me like I'm mad. Like, why would you ever watch TV?
Yeah, I was about to say, you're speaking about the TV hinterlands here. I have not seen this.
It's out clubbing on a Saturday night.
Bangers. Me every night.
Fair enough. But it is a kind of, it's become an iconic slot for showcasing the best of international drama. And this is, and the reason I picked this was because, you know, I kind of test out every one of these. I watched the first episode of all of these shows because there have been some absolutely brilliant treats among them, particularly The Bridge, which is became an iconic thing. And I started watching this one, and it's beautifully filmed. That's the first thing to say about it. It stars Aaron Peterson as Detective Jay Swan in the outback in Australia, and he's a kind of very taciturn, almost Clint Eastwood style hero cop who hardly says anything to anyone and looks kind of inherently mean. He's working with the brilliant Judy Davis, the legendary Australian actress Judy Davis, who's been in loads of fantastic films, often playing kind of wild American women who are slightly kind of on the edge, if you like. She's playing this very down-to-earth Australian cop who kind of has brought him in. She needs a detective to sort out the mystery of two young guys who've disappeared off the face of the earth when they were kind of doing their job, which is going around in some farm, filling up some farming stations. And so it begins with this deserted kind of white van thing that they arrived in. They've disappeared, beautifully shot, using those outback locations in a stunningly beautiful way, the kind of big overhead shots of the landscape a lot. But more important than that, I think I really love these two main characters, the cop and the detective, Judy Davis and Aaron Peterson. I love the way they're kind of slowly getting to know each other. And it's a classic, you know, all of these things, it's a kind of classic setup. It's ostensibly, it's a standard kind of crime drama with a mystery, two mismatched cops and all of that. But the detail of it and the performances by these two people, and as I say, the very, very cinematic way it's filmed. I think it's one of the most cinematic things I've seen in this slot, I have to say, even including The Bridge. That's why I picked it and that's why I like it. And I've so far watched the first two episodes. So they go out in double bills, which is quite clever, because the first episode is the setup, and the second episode you're getting all the kind of the possible suspects as to what is happening and why these two guys disappeared. And it's looking at, you know, it's looking at issues for Aborigines still in Australia. There's a lot of stuff about the class conflict. You know, we see how they live and how the kind of white privileged people live. All of that is done very light touch in the background. The mystery is really compelling, I think.
Okay, so how many parts how many nights?
I think it's 8 parts over the next 4 weeks, so they show 2 each week. And I think it will reward your attention.
You are all about the rewards this afternoon, Lloyd Hilton.
Boy, the delayed gratification, Hilton.
Sometimes you need to delay it, James.
No, lies.
All right.
Give it me all now.
And you didn't think we'd work wanking into the podcast this week. Hooray!
I knew we would.
Now it's time for TV news. And I would like to kick us off with something I'm very excited about, which is Aaron Paul being cast in the next season of Westworld. We know nothing. I mean, it could be on tomorrow and we'd still know nothing because they don't tell us anything. The showrunners talked at the end of season 2 about there being a radical shift in season 3. We don't know what that means. We do know that they're out in the real world and we don't know if he'll be human or host. I mean, I just think he's incredible. Everything he's in, like, you've got to hope that some of the amazing charisma and energy he brings to screen, regardless of whatever he's in, will translate. Do we think he'll be human?
Seen Need
Do we
for
think
Speed, he'll be right? Just saying.
We don't talk about that. Human or host? What are we saying?
I hope he'll be human because I mean, I love Westworld, but I'm more interested intrinsically always in human characters than I am non-human characters. It's just the way I am. I love him as
Humanist.
Well. He was even good in that terrible Fast and Furious knockoff film that he did. Is that the one you just mentioned?
Yes.
Sorry. He whispered it.
No.
He whispered it.
No, he wasn't.
Yes.
He
I'm
was
sticking
dreadful.
With it. I did a junket interview with him for that film and he was lovely. So I'm sticking with
him. But don't you think, and actually I think we're short on amazing male characters now in Westworld. I think the female characters in Westworld are just incredible and they're the things you really hold on to every week, and the next day they're the people you're really talking about. And I think an injection of a brilliant new male character. Yeah.
And there have been some slightly dodgy male ones, like the English guy.
Yeah. What was that about?
I'm hopeful.
We're hopeful. James?
Yeah.
I've written down yelling. I've just written down his name and yelling. That means I hope he's going to do some yelling.
I think he'll be a character. I do. I've thought about it a lot. I'm fairly certain he'll play a role.
Is that the extent of your Westworld knowledge?
Yeah, I think he's going to be. Maybe he's one of the 5 marbles.
Yes, that they lost. Right, let's move on. Boyd,
yes.
Talk to me about Trust Me.
Trust Me. So Trust Me, I think this is quite a funny story, because Trust Me was BBC One's big drama last year, starring Jodie Whittaker. And she played this nurse who turned herself into a doctor and started going around operating on people, even though she'd never been trained. And it was an intrinsically, incredibly eye-catching premise that, by the way, was based on true stories of lots of fake doctors out there, apparently hundreds of them. And it was a great showcase for her. And then, of course, it was announced she was the doctor in Doctor Who. So she is no longer going to be in it. But they've recast her role, played by Alfred Enoch from How to Get Away with Murder, who's a great young actor, but obviously he's not playing the same character. So what they're going to do is they're rebooting the whole show. So it's kind of like a medical thriller with a completely new character played by Alfred Enoch at the centre of the show, who is going to be Corporal Jamie McCain, survivor of an enemy attack during some kind of war, who's got a spinal injury and is in hospital, and he watches as his fellow patients die unexpectedly around him. I quite like the idea of that premise.
What do they share?
So the only thing that, trust me, season 1 and 2 are going to share in common are that they're set mainly in hospitals and there's some bad people going around killing people, and that it's created by the same person, Dan Sefton, who wrote and created the show.
Is this a contractual thing? Like, when playing the doctor, you also can't play a doctor? In the same way that, like, when someone's cast as Bond, they're not allowed to be in any other film where they wear a dinner suit because of the dinner suit.
Correct?
Yeah, so if you're cast as Bond, you can't wear a dinner suit in another film. It's entirely possible I've made that up, but I'm almost certain it's a fact, so Google that.
So you're telling me Daniel Craig has never, since starting as Bond, he's never worn a suit on screen?
Sure, why not? No, suit's fine, but dinner suit, I'm fairly certain it only only applies to dinner suits.
By dinner suit, do you mean dicky bag?
Yeah, yeah, with the bow tie and shit. So can't do any of that. So can't go to any bar mitzvahs or anything while being Bond. So
I'm
think
pretty
clearly,
sure.
Clearly,
I hate to contradict you, but I'm pretty sure Daniel Craig went to the GQ Awards whilst playing Bond and was in a dinner suit
in a role, like on screen. Like you can do it in his personal life.
What
that's
about driving
fine.
A car? So, what about shagging women?
Jodie Foster, for example. Jodie Whittaker, for example, cannot play a doctor, but can presumably operate on someone in her own personal life without repercussions. That's also a fact. She's not allowed to time travel while she's playing.
But why didn't they just start a brand new show?
That's the good question, because it does tap into the thing that people don't get annoyed about now, where a seemingly limited series ends up being turned into more than one series of everything. Anything that's successful on TV now has to have more than one series, and that's why it's going to happen.
So what
series.
You're saying is they're just asking us to trust them.
He's good, isn't he?
Okay, fine. So that's.
But I like Dan Sefton, the writer, so I'll give it a go.
Okay. You will trust him.
I'm very open.
I mean, it sounds ridiculous.
It does sound ridiculous.
But there you go. And now let's talk about. I really want to talk about the Sabrina trailer.
This is not actually
a sentence I thought I'd say. So if we had a slight disagreement about this, right, Boyd? Because you were trying to sell me this and I was rolling my eyes. Because obviously, to me, Sabrina is Sabrina the Teenage Witch. 1990s, peppy. It exists in my brain next to Joey Lawrence and Blossom and those hats that turned up at the front and had flowers on them and culottes. So I couldn't really see how this was going to be good. And you were kind of telling me how it was. And the trailer dropped a few days ago. And I think it's important to note that obviously it's based on the comic book run from the Archie horror titles, right? So
exactly.
It is meant to be scary and it is meant to have a horror riff. The trailer is a little bit like The Craft meets American Horror Story, meets Stranger Things, meets Charmed, which I love to talk about any given opportunity. It looks properly scary. It looks like it's really actually well shot and well made. Tonally, it's about as far away as you can get from Sabrina the Teenage Witch as anything. And I think I am excited.
I have to be careful because I've seen the first few episodes of this show, by the by. So, and I'm strictly embargoed, of course, from saying what I think of it. But all I would say is that there was an incredible array of quite correct references there. So I think that's all in there, without doubt. I mean, I think it is trying to be properly scary. That's the most exciting thing about it. We'll see whether it succeeds or not. But, you know, in the advanced kind of materials of it, they even compare it to things like The Exorcist, which, you know, I mean, we'll park that for a bit. But it's going for it. It's definitely going for it in every way. Like, it's incredibly stylized. Mm. It's bold and daring. There's stuff about sexuality in there. It's definitely typically bold Netflix way of doing Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So assume for a second that I've never watched an episode of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, even though Melissa Joan Hart follows me on Twitter. Just sort of get that in there. So this is the one with the talking cat, right?
Yes.
And this is the sequel to the campy show about the talking
cat. It's a reboot.
It's a reboot. It's a reimagination.
Oh, fine,
it's
fine. Total, okay.
It's an update. It's making it valid so for the times we live in now.
Sabrina the Emo Witch is essentially what this is.
Oh, my God. So good. There's your headline there.
Right.
I mean, yes.
Okay.
Are you more interested in
it? I am. And the cat talks still?
I didn't see the cat in the trailer.
There are freaky, scary cats, as far as I can remember. I'm not sure if they actually talk.
You've kind of ever so slightly sold me on this, but then, you know, I was going to bat for fucking Discovery of Witches last week, so what the hell do I know?
Well, and is it a crossover with Riverdale, or is it just by the same team?
It's just by the same team.
It's just by the same team.
To start with, I guess there's room for crossover. There will be room for crossover. Yeah, and that must be a temptation, considering it is by the same team.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that is starting on Netflix at the end of October, I think October 28th. Now, time for one more.
Well, I'm going to jump in and derail what you were about to say. And say,
funnily enough,
because this is what I do here. That's my whole role on this podcast. The most exhausting news of the week has to be that we can look forward to another decade of The Walking Dead.
Oh, yes.
And I'm so tired now, having heard that. So this is what they were talking about, The Walking Dead, what the future of The Walking Dead would be. And the new showrunner mentioned that they have a plan that spans the next decade. And I think everyone collectively just sort of like took a steadying sigh at that point. Because The Walking Dead at the best of times is exhausting. It takes forever to get anywhere. It's incredibly bleak and nihilistic, and there's two of them already. So either this is now going to go on for another 10 years, or there will be multiple spin-offs that will do other things. Presumably some kind of knockabout sex comedy with zombies will be part of it. But I just...
Is it the length of time that's bothering you?
Yeah, if they said, oh, we've got a plan for the next 2 years, I'd have been like, oh, okay, there'll be... But just the thought of sitting through 10 more years of this, and I watched both of these shows still. I can still enjoy them enough to to tune in each week. But it is very, very hard going sometimes. And I think we're, certainly with The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead being its own thing, The Walking Dead now is not up to date with the comics, but it's certainly not far off. I think we're only one storyline behind the comics at this point. So
two
we're getting
words,
quite close.
Milking it.
I mean, yes, is exactly what's happening. It feels a little bit like this has been off the boil for a while now, I think. I think the whole Negan debacle really strained everyone's tolerance. I think that show was great, even if it was a little bit ponderous. And then Negan came in, and I love Jeffrey Dean Morgan, and I think he's brilliant. I actually really enjoy him in this role because he's so over the top. But you had that episode of incredibly shocking violence, which I think turned off a lot of viewers. And then they almost, to add insult to injury, they then made you sit for 3 years and watch nothing happen as these people just shouted at each other on the radio. And at this point, I just feel like, you know, people have done less time for murder. I can't do another 10 years of The Walking Dead.
But when it comes to The Walking Dead, are you excited about the new season?
I'm interested, yes. Right. Like, so I read the comics, and I enjoyed the time jump that came after the kind of all-out War Negan storyline, and you had an older Rick, and the world had shifted. Because I think this is one of these shows where it's about humans and zombies are the backdrop. The world as a whole is kind of the wallpaper for this show. And I thought at that point we were overdue a shift in the scenery. And I like the fact that it's now about crumbling infrastructure and it's about them building up a society. And it's about, you know, people who dress as zombies and cut their faces off. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, I'm interested in this season. But I worry a little bit, not so much that Andrew Lincoln's going, but the fact that Lauren Cohen's going as well, and she's great in that show. And they said, oh, it'd be great because we're going to allow the supporting cast a chance to shine. And I think it does have a strong supporting cast, but I worry that they may misstep in trying to overcompensate for the lack of having a central leading man. I wonder whether they might actually lose what makes the show great. I don't know. If that's not, in fact, already been lost. But we'll see. I will definitely stick it out for one more season. But at this point, that is all I'm prepared to promise.
Well, and that's all. I always think if you throw too far ahead, you miss people being in the moment right now, which is all it should be about right this minute, is setting people up for him leaving and for this final season. I think as soon as you start throwing beyond that, it really stops people being able to enjoy it right in that moment.
Absolutely. I'm excited to see how it works out, how he leaves, how they deal with that and what happens after that. But I agree with you totally. They should not have announced this.
Never.
No, I don't want to know.
Because it's exhausting. Yeah. Can I just say, I love the fact that we're recording this podcast in a meeting room next to the Empire office. So bursts of sporadic laughter come. And it's like we've got our own little laugh track going.
It's at least it's laughter and not tears.
Yeah, and they're not
screaming, screaming in misery.
And I love the fact that I have to go and do the same thing now at the BBC. Sorry.
Also, His Dark Materials is getting a season two.
Don't really care about that. Right, so that is it for the second Pilot TV podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We will see you next Monday. And in the meantime, you can find Pilot TV on YouTube, iTunes, Twitter, Facebook.
We planned out the next 10 years of the Pilot
Instagram.
TV podcast for your entertainment.
Stick with us for the next decade. It'll get good after 4 years. Thank you. See you next week.